Well, good morning. Wow, that's bright. How is everybody? Not jet lagged like I am, I suppose. I hope you probably know that I was gone. Faith and I actually both were gone the last couple of weeks or so. Missed the last two Sundays. I didn't miss the last two Sundays. I just wasn't here. We had the last two Sundays in Asia. Sunday before last, we were in Singapore. Did a leadership retreat with them and spent some time gathering around God's love and the truth that drives that. And then we were in Singapore for about 4 days, 4 or 5 days. I've kind of lost track. We flew then to Manila, and I used one of the days that we were there to go up to the plantation with Joseph Tanchi and with one of the investors in the plantation. And then we went from there, flew to Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, and then traveled as a family because for the first time in 3.5 years, our entire family over there was together, all the kids and their spouses and all the grandkids, and it was just a wonderful time. We went to Kuantan on the northeast coast of Malaysia, there by the sea, and got acquainted with several sand fleas and one thing or another, but we were able to spend some wonderful time together. Not only worshiping, but talking about ministry as we're all involved in the same sort of thing. It was just a very precious time for which I'm very thankful. We then bused down to Singapore and headed back from Singapore here. And some of you may know that my plan for a long time has been to speak here this morning and then head for Nigeria this afternoon. I was going to speak at church and then head out. But there were some very significant complications with my visa, as in I needed one and didn't get one, which is pretty serious. And so I will not be going to Nigeria, which is it's kind of good news for my heart. We were pretty tired after this trip, and to run out again would have been, I know my wife has said that this is God's grace to us and particularly to me at this point. We've been studying the book of John in a series entitled So That You May Know. And we've used that as kind of a launching point to say up here, so that they may know. And that's the real reason that we learn things. That's the real reason that God teaches us things from His Word. He teaches us things and He expects us to put them into practice in our own lives. And then He expects that we'll pass those on to other people who will put them into practice in their lives and then pass them on to other people. Discipleship in this generational idea, because you and I, we're not going to be here forever. We're not always going to be around. But so that you may know, and for this morning, I should probably turn this on if I want it to actually work. And for this morning, where the title of the message is going to be So That You May Know the Good Shepherd. It's part 21 of a 42-part series. So we are pretty close to halfway done with the year. And we'll be looking at John chapter 10, verses 1 to 21, where we'll find a sort of a bit of a riddle. Jesus is going to speak in an allegory, and every bit and piece of that allegory is going to have meaning. And I'm going to try not to put you on the spot too much, but I want you to think through with me what the various parts of the allegory mean, because he's going to present us with some absolutely deep truth. We're studying the book of John, the Gospel of John, this entire year. And the reason that we're doing that is because, having come through the book of Genesis, and by the way, I probably will reference Genesis this morning relative to something that's going to be said by way of review in the book of John. But we studied Genesis together, and we met Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, and we studied Acts together, and we met the Apostle Paul and Peter and all of these guys that have helped to shape the way we look at the world. Then we studied the book of Romans, and Romans made it really, really clear on a very deep level that how we look at the world, how we look at God, how we look at our opportunities makes all the difference in the outcome in our lives. Makes the difference between joy and sadness, the difference between peace and dissatisfaction. It makes all of the difference in the world. And the reason that Paul was able to write the things that he wrote in the book of Romans is because of the things that Jesus said and did in the book of John. And John has a goal in bringing us this message. He actually says in John chapter 20, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. There was so much that he did that I didn't write down, John says. I actually cherry-picked. I'm telling you the story that made a difference to me. That's what he's doing for us. He was on a journey, and he's recording his journey for us. John is a very intelligent man. He's a very honest man. He looked very closely at everything that was happening. And he's saying, you know, there's some things that made a real difference for me relative to understanding who Jesus is. But these are written, the things that I did write, so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. He's our best friend. John is our best friend this year because he's taking us to the place where not only do we have something that we believe, but we actually have life. We actually have life, and we're going to look at that a little bit this morning in greater detail than we have in the past. The kind of lives that we're living. I see you on Sunday mornings, and I don't mean to judge, because I'm not a dancer when it comes to worship, something for which I think you should be thankful. But I'm not a dancer when it comes to worship, but I watch your faces, and I listen to your voices, and I wonder sometimes if your worship at a St. Louis Cardinals game isn't a little more ardent, a little more full of fervor than it is here on a Sunday morning as we reflect on what God has done for us during the week. I don't mean that in any way as a guilt trip, but it could be a reflection of life as you understand it. The kind of life that you believe you have received from Jesus. Jesus came that you might have life. Jesus came that I might have life. Thank you so much for that. Reminded me of Vice President Pence. I saw him in an interview, and he was talking about a bill that they're trying to pass. He and the president are trying to pass. And he actually said, just so deadpan, we need your support and we need your enthusiasm. I thought, yeah, we do. You know, if you want me to get behind this thing, it'd be nice if you showed that you were behind it. But what kind of life are we living? What is it that we have to offer other people? And forgetting that, what is it that we experience on a daily basis? How full of joy are you? How irrepressible are you? How unstoppable are you in your daily life? We need to talk about that this morning, and it's another one of those things, if we don't get to it, we won't get it done. So anyway, John came to give us life, and last week we looked at John chapter 9 and met a man who had been born blind. And it's important that we understand that this man had been was born blind, and what it was obvious that he had been born blind. Let's be clear about that. The disciples that were there with Jesus were not doctors. They were not physicians. Luke eventually will become a physician. The guy that writes the book of Acts is a physician. But these guys are not physicians. They're fishermen. They're tax collectors. And with one glance, they were able to determine, looking at this man, that he had been born blind. So they knew that he was blind, and they knew that he had been born blind. This was not the result of an illness or an accident. It's apparent, I think, to me, I realize it's speculation, but I believe he was born without eyes. He was born without the physical capacity to see, just these sunken hollows covered by eyelids. And that's why when they look at him, they say, hey, this guy was born blind. Who sinned, him or his mother, that he would be born blind, that he should be asked to go through this? So they see this man born blind, but there's two things that strike me in that story. And Jason brought them out very well. By the way, I was so thankful listening to those messages on the way home from the airport. Because, listen, if messages, after a trip like that, if a message can keep me awake, it's a good message, okay? Those were good messages. They were on par with anything that was done anywhere in the United States these past two weekends. I'm absolutely confident of that, as these guys have upped their game in presenting the word to you. I'm just really, really thankful. But here's this guy, and the two things that strike me as I watch that, as I listen to the story, are the growth of the man's faith and the simplicity of his testimony. It just slaps me in the face when I study that passage. We can see the growth in his faith by the things that he says as he's interviewed, because they take him in and they give him the third degree, the Sanhedrin does. They cross-examine him relative to what's happening. And when they first ask him, what happened to you? Do you remember what he says? The man that is called Jesus healed me. The man that is called Jesus made it possible for me to receive my sight. Later in the story, he insists that Jesus is a prophet. So there's a significant step up. And then he insists that Jesus is a man from God. And he's shocked that the Pharisees, the Sanhedrin, can't figure that out. He just gave sight to a man born blind. And you don't know where he's from. He insists that he's a man that has come from God. And by the end of the story, do you remember what happened when Jesus goes and finds him? He actually falls on his knees before Jesus, calls him Lord, and worships him. So Jesus, over the space of just a very few minutes, goes from being the man that they call Jesus to the Lord and Master in this man's life, someone who is worthy of worship. He progresses in his faith because he continues to learn new things about Jesus, just like we've been learning new things about Jesus as we've had our time together in the book of John. But he makes the difference in his own life of making up his mind that he's gonna put those things into practice in his life. He's going to believe everything he learns about Jesus, and he's going to make it a reality in his life. God's grace in that regard is not going to come up empty-handed in the life of this man who has been born blind. And I trust the same thing is true of us. We see the simplicity of his faith by the statement that he makes to the Jewish authorities when he says that he doesn't know whether Jesus is a sinner or not. That was what they asked him to say. This man is a sinner. He ends up saying, I don't know if he's a sinner or not. He says, here's all I know, okay? This is it. You ready? I used to be blind. Now I can see. That's all I got. That's all I got. I used to be blind, and now I can see. This reminds us of all the times that we felt incompetent. Does that happen to you sometimes? When you're in a situation where you know you should say something about Jesus, has that ever happened to you? And we've gained some perspective on the book from the book of John, because John chapter 1 and John chapter 8 talks about this well of water, the Spirit of God as he bubbles up within us. Could I suggest something to you? The next time you're in a situation where you know you should say something about Jesus, I should, please understand that it takes more work not to say something than it does to say something. That's the way it is for me. Well, it might not be politically correct, or this person might not be ready to hear it, or I'm not sure that we have time. Oh, I come up with a thought. It's work coming up with those excuses. Stop it. Stop it with the excuses. Let it out. That's the way a spring works. It's hard to stop up a spring. It's hard to stop a leak once a leak has gotten started. And when that's leaking out of you, my goodness, just speak up. But what we end up saying is, what if he asks a question that I can't answer? Well, what if I end up looking stupid because he uses some part of the, Apocrypha or something like that? I think an apostle and an epistle are husband and wife, so how am I supposed to answer his question? Right? I'm just going to look stupid by the time I'm done. That's the way we reason. And we use the effort to keep the Spirit of God contained. We don't want to look stupid. But this guy, this man who was born blind and is healed, goes and takes the chance. Not much I do know, but here's what I do know. And I've been thinking a lot about the Philippine team, because they're going to leave 3 weeks from today. They won't be in church 3 weeks from today. They'll be in the air by the time we're all fellowshipping with one another and on their way over there to speak to an unreached people group, representatives of an unreached people group who have not heard about Jesus, who don't know what Jesus did. They may have heard his name and they may have some background information on him, but they don't know the gospel the way you and I know the gospel. And so they're going to be in a place where they're sharing the gospel, where they're sharing their stories with people who have never heard about Jesus. And not only are they going to be, they're going to be doing it cross-culturally, through an interpreter. And I don't know if you've ever had that opportunity, but oh my goodness, buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride. And so it would be easy for the people that are going to be intimidated. And I know a lot of you are here this morning, and so I want to say to you, listen, learn something from the man born blind. And I want to say to the rest of you that if the people that are going on that trip can take something from the man born blind, then we can too. If it works in that situation, it'll work in the situation that we find ourselves in today. We have to appreciate the simplicity of this man's testimony. when he says, I don't have all my doctrine straight, and I'm not going to pretend to, but there's one thing I do know for sure. I used to be blind, but now I can see. It ought to encourage us. We don't have to have all the answers. You don't. You don't have to have all the answers to all the questions that people can possibly ask about this. All you have to know is your story. Here's what I used to be, and here's what I am today. Now, Jesus is the explanation. I can't come up with any other explanation for that than Jesus. All we have to know is what Jesus did for us and be willing to share it. And looking at the sequence there of how his faith increased and when the way he finally shares his testimony, you know what it reminds me of? An old song that I know you know. You could probably sing the first verse. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. Was blind, but now I see. You don't suppose that John Newton had read John chapter 9 before writing that song. I once was blind, but now I see. Well, it's time to get started on the passage for this morning because it's going to be tied to the passage that we looked at last week. And if we're going to get out of this passage what the Spirit of God has put into it, then I think we ought to start by reading it together as we always do. Would you stand with me in the presence out of reverence to God, respect for His Word? We're going to read John chapter 10, verses 1 through 10 together aloud, and then we'll get to the passage. Read it with me if you would. Very truly I tell you, Pharisees, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes on ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. But they will never follow a stranger. In fact, they will run away from him because they do not recognize a stranger's voice. Jesus used this figure of speech, but the Pharisees did not understand what he was telling them. Therefore, Jesus said again, "Very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I am come that they may have life and have it to the full." We know that God blesses us when we read His Word, so take your seats. Story from God's Word this morning comes from right here in John chapter 10, and I'm going to stay close to my notes as I tell it to you because it involves a lot of conversation, a lot of things that Jesus actually said, and so I don't want to freelance that too much, but I'd welcome you to turn there as I tell the story in John chapter 10. As the story begins, Jesus has just healed the man born blind. I realize that was in chapter 9 and this is in chapter 10, but chapters came later. This used to be all one cohesive story. And so as we flow from 9 into 10, Jesus has just healed the man born blind, which is an amazing thing by any account. Because if a man has been diseased and gone blind, or has a disease that makes him blind, or is in an accident that makes him blind, it would be a remarkable thing for someone to come along and heal them. Restoring the sight of someone who is injured in an accident is amazing, but not quite as amazing as giving sight to a man who was born blind. Think about it. This is not just a miracle. It's an act of creation. Stop and think. The man had been born blind, and anyone who looked at him, as we mentioned earlier, could tell. They could tell that he'd been born blind, so there must have been some type of physical deformity, perhaps eye sockets that were empty and caved in eyelids. We don't know for sure. But the disciples picked up on it immediately that he had been born blind. He was born without the capacity to see, the physical capacity. And that's why when we say that when Jesus healed the man, he wasn't just performing a miracle. It was more than a miracle. It was actually an act of creation. Think about what he used. Do you remember Genesis, when we studied Genesis together at the very beginning? That God took the clay of the ground, the dust of the ground, and shaped a body for Adam, Jesus does the same thing. He takes some dust and turns it into clay and wipes it across that man's eyes. This is an act of creation. This is way more than simply the Messiah showing up and doing a trick. This is an act of creation. Where eyes were not before, eyes are now. I get goose pimples when I think about it, when I think about him reenacting that scene from Genesis chapter 1. When the Jewish authorities then insist that this man tell them who Jesus is, you tell us who Jesus is, I love it because he uses the most powerful means of all. He turns the argument right back around on them and says, look, I didn't have the physical capacity to see, and now I'm seeing. I say, who do you think he is? He actually says, well, this is amazing. That's the way he phrases it. This is amazing. He opened the eyes of a man who was born blind, and yet you don't know where he's from. How can that possibly be? He turns it right back on them. He created my sight. So who do you think he is? And there were people gathered in the crowd who took this to be a sign of the fact that Jesus was the Messiah. But there were others gathered in the crowd, including the man who had been healed, that took it as much more. He's more than the Messiah. They've taken it as a sign that he's God, that Jesus is Lord. And now he's going to challenge the Pharisees and try to help them understand that the temple had always been the place where people could come and meet with God. But now the temple, well, it's about to pass away. That's about to change. Jesus is going to become the way to God. He wants to be clear about that. And in this allegory that he's about to tell, well, I don't want to give away too much because I want you to do some work before we're done. I don't want to entertain you. I want to make you think. But in this allegory that he's about to tell, he's going to talk about a temple. Well, he's going to talk about a sheep pen, so I gave that away. But he's going to talk about a sheep pen, and he's going to talk about sheep, and he's going to talk about shepherds, and he's going to talk about hired hands. And all of those are going to mean something. So listen to the story as it's told, and as you relate to it, wonder what God is saying through it. Jesus is about to say that he's the good shepherd who gives his life for the sheep. And with that background, this is the story from God's word from John chapter 10, verses 11 to 20. Jesus, as we mentioned, is in a discussion. I suppose you could call it that. It's really more of a debate. It might even be construed as an argument with the Pharisees and the members of the Sanhedrin. Now, there were Pharisees on the Sanhedrin, but all of the Pharisees were gathered there, even the ones that weren't part of it. They're trying to keep Jesus out. They're trying to shut him out. He's in a debate with them, and he's about to liken the temple to a sheep pen. And he's going to have something to say, as he does, to the shepherds. But this is the way he begins. I am the good shepherd, Jesus says. And the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Now, a hired hand, he's not going to lay down his life for the sheep because the sheep don't belong to him. They belong to the shepherd. His hired hand cares only about himself. He doesn't really care about the sheep. So when he sees, for example, a wolf coming to attack the sheep, he won't interpose himself. He won't stand between the wolf and the sheep. He's just going to run away because he only cares about himself. He doesn't care about the sheep at all. I am the good shepherd, Jesus said, and I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know my Father, and because I know my sheep, I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep, Jesus said. I have other sheep that are not part of this fold, and I must bring those sheep as well. There will be one sheep, there will be one flock, and one shepherd when the time comes. That time is not yet, but it is coming. And by the way, when I lay down my life for the sheep, no man will take my life from me. No man can take my life from me. I have the capacity, I have the ability to lay down my life, and I have the ability to take it up again. In fact, I have authority from the Father to lay down my life and take it up again. This is what the Father has told me to do. Of course, at that point, The Pharisees and Jewish authorities, the Pharisees and Jewish authorities, well, they get in an argument. They start talking to one another and saying, this man is obviously demon-possessed. I mean, he's a raving lunatic. He's a madman. So why on earth should we listen to him? We shouldn't even be giving him the time of day. To which the others reply, who are on the other side of the fence, well, you know, this isn't the sort of thing that a raving lunatic would say. This isn't the sort of thing that a demon-possessed person would say. And oh, by the way, when was the last time you heard of a demon opening the eyes of a man who was born blind? So they're caught. They're stuck. They're divided. And that is the story from God's Word. The passage for this morning, Jesus is about to lay out an allegory, a metaphor, a parable, where he is both revealing truth and at the same time concealing truth. Remember that Jesus has just healed a man that was born blind. And the man responded by worshiping Jesus and falling down before him and calling him Lord. But the Pharisees haven't taken that attitude at all. They've responded by putting the man out of the synagogue. Did you catch that last week? They threw him out of the synagogue because he believed in the man who healed, who gave sight to his eyes. You shouldn't believe in him. Get out of the synagogue. We don't want anything to do with you. He was praising God for healing him, but they forced him out of the synagogue. So Jesus comes up with an allegory to show them, to point out to them in fairly clear terms how wrong they were to put that man out of the synagogue and how wrong they were in the way that they were relating to Jesus. And the Pharisees, surprise, surprise, are not going to get it. They're not going to catch on to what Jesus means. They're going to miss the point. It's kind of their habit. It's the pattern that's been established. But we're going to try to get the point this morning and look at the bits and pieces. And if you're part of a small group, if you're not part of a small group, this would be a great week to be part of one because we're going to drill down into this even deeper during small group. But let's see if we can get this. Look at this picture of how sheep pens were built in the early first century there in Jerusalem. Take a look at the way that looks. This is a modern-day sheep pen. Remember, they didn't have cameras back then. And so the shepherd is standing there in front of the sheep pen, but that's pretty much how a sheep pen would look. There'd often be briars wrapped around those sticks that were there. It was intended to keep sheep in, right? And to keep predators and thieves out. Not a very complicated structure, but a very purposeful structure. And now it's time to drill down into this parable that Jesus has just told, this thing that you and I just read. And I guess we could start with the sheep. What do the sheep in the sheep pen stand for? This may be the easiest of all the questions I ask. What do the sheep in the sheep pen stand for? Give it a minute. Some people are nodding, which it's hard for me to hear the rattle from this distance, but... us, yeah, the sheep is us. We know that because of Psalm 100. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. That's how God considers us. He considers us himself to be the shepherd who is shepherding the sheep, and he's talking about the people of God, the people that have followed him, have made a point of following him. Well, what about the sheep pen then? What does that represent? Kind of gave that away a little while ago, but as Jesus begins the parable, the sheep pen is Judaism or the temple or the sacrifices or that entire religious system that was there in place. Because back in those days, if you wanted to have a relationship with God, you had to go to the temple. And so what Jesus is really talking about is a relationship with God, a relationship with the shepherd. That's what the sheep have. As they go into the sheep pen, they're under the shepherd's care. They have a relationship. They're tied deeply to him. If you wanted to be forgiven back in those days, if you wanted to become one of the people of God, a Gentile could not go into the temple and become one of the people of God without special ceremonies. And even after that, there were limitations as to how far they could go into the temple. And I'm not complaining about that today. I'm just saying that Jesus is talking about the people of God being forgiven and having a relationship with God, coming close to Him. So we have God's people, the sheep, being kept safe in the sheep pen of Judaism and the temple. Of course, where you have sheep and a sheep pen, you have to have food. Okay, good. That's absolutely right. But now you're going to think I was sneaking up on you. I wasn't. I didn't mean to sneak up on you. You have to have a shepherd. Right? If you've got a sheep pen, or at least some hired hands, some people that are hired to take care of the sheep. And when the shepherd goes in to take care of the sheep, how does the shepherd get into the sheep pen? This is not a tricky question. Have a look there. What do you suppose that shepherd is about to do? He's going to walk right through the gate, right? He's going to go through the gate, and that's how the shepherd gets into the sheep pen. This is a lot less complicated than you might have thought. But if you were to see somebody on the back, way back there, climbing over the fence, what would you suspect? Uh-oh, there you go. That's as simple as that. Uh-oh. That's what the shepherd would be saying as he starts swinging his staff. Because you would think that it's a thief. Maybe somebody who would come in to steal the sheep. Us, the people of God. And that's pretty much what Jesus is talking about in verses 1 and 2. Very truly, I tell you, Pharisees, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. But what's this gate that he's talking about? Let's go back to that picture there. What's the gate? Well, it's the gate that the shepherd goes in. There's two different gates mentioned in this parable. One is the gate that the shepherd goes in. The other is the gate that the sheep go in. And it's going to be different. I'll explain in a little while why it's different. But what is this gate that he's talking about? What gate had Jesus come through as the good shepherd? He says that he entered through the gate. Any thoughts on that, this gate that Jesus had entered through? You don't have to shout it out. I know how terrifying that can be. But if you're sitting there thinking, I bet you have the background for this because we studied John chapter 1 earlier in the year, where we learned that Jesus walked through the gate of the Old Testament prophecies. Remember one of the things they're accusing him of? He can't be the Messiah because he was born in Galilee. No, he wasn't. He was born in Bethlehem of Judea as a descendant of King David. He walked right through the gate. Every one of the Old Testament prophecies about Jesus, Jesus fulfilled. He proved that he was the Messiah by going through the gate of the Old Testament prophecies. That proves that he's the true shepherd. He fulfilled all of the prophecies. Others had come claiming to be the Messiah, but they had to climb up over because the Old Testament prophecies did not apply to them, did not come true in their lives. Jesus walked through the gate of the Old Testament prophecies. So Jesus is saying that he's the true shepherd because he came through the gate. But I want you to realize Judaism back in those days was a very close society. And some people were allowed in, and some people were not allowed in. And in the process of all of that, the Pharisees have just done something. You remember what it was? They just threw a man out of the synagogue. They threw a man out of Judaism because of what he believed. They honestly believed themselves to be the gatekeepers. That's why they can throw people out and let people in. They're trying to keep Jesus out. They're trying to keep the man who had been born blind out. And as you might expect, Jesus goes after that notion as well by saying that when he approached the gate, work with me here, the gatekeeper opened the door for him. Look at verse 3. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. Who's the gatekeeper? Obviously, it wasn't the Pharisees, because the Pharisees were trying to keep Jesus out. But somebody had actually let Jesus in when he approached the gate. Are you whispering to each other? You don't have to show all of us how clever you are, but at least show your wife or something, you know? Just lean over and say it was Alexander the Great. I don't know. Whatever it is you think, it wasn't Alexander the Great. That was a bad hint. Who's the gatekeeper? Well, again, you've studied John right from the very beginning, as John has told us this story, and there was somebody right at the very beginning when Jesus walked up to the gate that pointed to him and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. There is the promised one. There's the one that we've been waiting for. John the baptizer is the gatekeeper in this case. He knows the Old Testament prophecies. He knows that Jesus has fulfilled them. And he opens the gate for Jesus to come in. And as you try to sort all of this out, don't miss this last part of what Jesus says here. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. He had been doing that from the very beginning. He called Matthew. He called Bartholomew. He called Peter. He called James. He called John. And you know what I'd like to suggest this morning? He's calling you. He's calling you, and he wants to lead you out of this protected place where we are, out there, where you can shine your light in a very dark place. That's what he does. That's how Jesus acts. Jesus has been calling people out of the old way of thinking and the old way of doing things. And then he doesn't abandon them. He stays right with them. That's the beautiful part. Once again, think about the man who had been born blind and suddenly is able to see. The Pharisees sent him out of the synagogue, left him out in the cold, which was the very thing that they were trying to do with Jesus. But Jesus wants to be clear, that's not what he's about. He hasn't come to exclude. Look at what it says in verses 4 and 5. When he has brought out all his own, he goes ahead of them. He's bringing some people out of Judaism. He goes ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. But they will never follow a stranger. In fact, they will run away from him because they do not recognize a stranger's voice. And there in verse 5, Jesus fills out for us the picture by once again referencing the man who had been born blind. Remember that Jesus had made clay and put clay over this man's eyes. I'm not liking this picture, but it's the best one I could find. He made clay and wiped it across those eye sockets, wiped it across those eyelids. And that means that prior to this time, Jesus does that and then says, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which, as Jason pointed out, means sent. He sent him down to Siloam. So the man has not seen Jesus at this point, but he's blind. And so you know how he would recognize Jesus if he sees him again? Does anybody know? By his voice. He's going to hear his voice and know who he is. How beautiful is that? This story that just occurs to Jesus out of nowhere. All of the details, all of the beautiful bits and pieces. Jesus hears that this man has been thrown out of the synagogue and goes and finds him. And I don't know how you've seen it, but how you have it pictured, but keep in mind that this man did not have the capacity. He had been born blind, so he had never seen, and that means that he wouldn't recognize a tree from a human being until a human being moved. He wouldn't know what an apple was without holding it in his hands. Have you thought about that? He had never seen one before. And so when Jesus walks up to him, he takes the time to speak to him and say, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" The man's response, "Who is he? Who is he so that I may believe in him? I don't care. I don't care who he, you just tell me who he is," because he recognized Jesus' voice. And I wonder if we can say the same. I wonder if we sit here on a Sunday morning and hear Jesus speak to us about things and then go out there and, well, we hear other influences. Because Lexus wants us to buy their cars and Bridal Cave wants us to go and visit. It's supposed to be cool this time of year. There's all kinds of things out there calling to us. And I've got nothing against Lexus. I mean, if you've got a Lexus and you feel spiritually like you need to get rid of it, give it to me. I would be glad to have it. I'm just saying. But we hear all kinds of voices. All kinds of things that call to us and try to grab our attention. And some of them we have to pay attention to. You've got to get up and go to work in the morning. When the alarm goes off, you can't lay there and say, "Well, I think I'll ignore that this morning." Don't do that because of what I said. But do we respond in the same way to Jesus' voice when we hear it? When the Spirit begins bubbling up. And we know it's time to speak up. We know we should say something. We know we should reach out. We come to church on Sunday morning and the Spirit speaks to us and we hear Jesus' voice and we say to ourselves, I'm going to be different this week. But as Casting Crowns puts it, somewhere between the altar and the door, something happens. We lose our resolve. And then we're back on Sunday morning just feeling guilty again. And that's not the life that Jesus has for us. Well, this story is about the sheep pen. It's a very well-crafted story. And all the pieces fit beautifully in place. And you would think that it would just grab the hearts of the Pharisees, wouldn't you? I mean, these were guys who knew God's word. And we're telling stories themselves. You'd expect that they'd just get it, right? Yeah, no. Look at verse 6. Jesus used this figure of speech, but the Pharisees didn't understand what he was telling them. Well, hello. Brand new day, isn't it? This is like a soap opera that's going on here. He tells the truth, and he tells it in such well-crafted ways, but they just don't get it because they aren't accustomed to dealing with this truth, with truth itself. Now, Jesus, again, has been talking about the sheep pen, and he'd come through the doorway of the Old Testament prophecies and promises. But now he has to talk about how the sheep get in, how the sheep find their way in and out of the sheep pen. He's talking about the temple and Judaism and how they come in. He's talking about the fact that he's actually going to take some of the sheep and lead them out. What would a person have to do if they wanted to become part of this new flock that Jesus was forming? Wouldn't you like to know that at this point? What would they have to do? Well, to understand the answer to that question, we'd have to look at that sheep pen right there. That's the way that I want you to notice the doorway. What do you see there in the doorway, in the gate where the sheep have gone in? The shepherd is sitting there. Do you know why that is? Because shepherds in the first century weren't well paid. They weren't. And so most of them could not afford a motion detector that they could put on the side of the sheep gate. Thank you for knowing that I'm joking. I worry about you sometimes. There were no motion detectors back then, right? But there was no way to tell whether the sheep went in and out. That's what motion detectors are handy for. We have a motion detector at our house, turns on the lights when we come home. Of course, it also turns on the lights when the armadillo walks across the yard. It can't be selective. That's the problem with a motion detector. So the shepherd would put the sheep into the fold, into the sheep pen, and then he would sit in the doorway. And now suddenly he's there in a place where he can keep the sheep in, unless they need to go out and find pasture, but he's going to do that as well. But he could also keep predators at bay. And so that's what he's talking about. He positioned himself in the gate, and if the sheep were going to get in, they had to go by him. And if they were going to get out, they had to go by him. And if a predator was going to get in, it had to go by the shepherd. And I don't know if this means anything to you, but this brings great comfort to my heart on any day to know that the shepherd is sitting in the gateway. He has become the gate of the sheep. Look what he says in verse 7. Therefore, Jesus said again, very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. So he's the shepherd and the gate for the sheep. And the Pharisees and the other leaders in Israel are not. Keep in mind that this argument has been broiling now for a long time. They've been turning it over and over that Jesus is not the Messiah. The Sanhedrin had decided he wasn't, but the common people had decided that he is. The hired hands have decided that he is not the shepherd. The sheep, however, have agreed together that he actually is. They had accepted him as the Messiah. And that's what he says in verses 8 and 9. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers. He's talking to the Pharisees. He's talking to the Sanhedrin, who were making their living by taking care of the sheep. But the sheep have not listened to them. You have said that I'm not the Messiah. They are not listening to you. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. Jesus is not planning on setting up a whole new set of rules and regulations that we have to keep. He's not asking us to be petty. He's not going to be someone who sits in as a sniper and waits to shoot the sheep as they put their heads up and try to live free. He's not going to do that. That was the job that the Pharisees understood. That was the job that the Sanhedrin understood. That was not what Jesus had in mind. He's not going to abuse the sheep at all. In fact, he wants the sheep to have life. He wants you to have life. Do you know how I know that today? Because of what he says in verse 10. The thief comes only to steal and to kill and destroy. I am come that they may have life and live a life burdened by rules. Were you looking at the screen while I read that? I count on you for a lot on a Sunday morning. I am come that they might have life and make sure that they go to church every Sunday morning and do. I am come that they might have life and never again go to a party. That's not what he says. Going to a party and partying can be two different things in all of our minds. But he's saying here, I'm come that they may have life and have it to the full. Is that your testimony today? Yeah, I know about the rules. We don't smoke and we don't chew and we don't go with the girls that do. Good girls go to heaven, bad girls go everywhere else. I know all about that. I know all about that, you say to yourself. And I'm not talking about being bad boys and girls. That's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm not talking about living loose moral lives. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm just saying that it's kind of sad that the people out there have more fun in the bar than we have when we're here together. And I wonder if we're doing it right. I wonder if we're really enjoying the kind of life he came here to give. He came to give us life, not a life that's drab, boring, and unfulfilled, not a life that's full of rules and regulations that have to be kept, but a life that is full of joy and adventure. That's what he wants. That was his plan. That was his dream for you. That's why I came. Well, we're at it here. Keep in mind that Jesus is saying to all of this to the Pharisees. They're going to succeed in a little while in taking him down. He has weeks to live at this point. They're going to succeed in taking him down, but he wants it to be clear to them and to you and to me as we bring this to a close that when they take him down, the reason that my Father loves me is that I laid down my life only to take it up again, 17 and 18. No one takes it from me. But I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father. When he laid his life down, it was his decision to go, not theirs. Not the Pharisees, not the Sanhedrin. He went for you. He went for you, but he went for one other reason, and I will close with this, I promise. He went for one other, do you know what that other reason was? Right here in verse 16, I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. Anybody know who these other sheep are? It's us, isn't it? That are not of this fold, he says as he stands in the temple teaching. I have other sheep that are not of this sheepfold. They're going to come from another place altogether. And I'm going to lead them out, and I'm going to lead you out. And my dream, Jesus says, is that there will be one sheep pen and one shepherd. Can I suggest something to you? I think it's high time that we get busy helping to make Jesus' dream a reality. Because there are other sheep out there that still need to become part of the fold. And we're about to send a team to the Philippines. And then we're going to send the youth to a place right here in the United States. But can I tell you something? We're not sending them to your house. We're not sending them to your neighborhood. We're not sending them to your office. We're not sending them to your friends. We're not sending them to your family. We're sending them away from here. And because we're not sending teams to go and do all of that, if your family, your friends, your office mates, your people, your friends at school, if they're going to hear the good news about Jesus, it's going to be because you told them. It's going to be because you told them. And I don't mean that as a guilt trip. I mean that as the most wonderful privilege that has ever occurred in all of history, because the shepherd of our souls has a dream that someday other sheep will follow him, and there will be one sheep pen and one shepherd. I say, it's high time we get involved in making that a reality. Will you stand with me in the presence? Father and our God, thank you today for the privilege that we have of knowing the true shepherd. Thank you that he made it so clear to us that he walked through the gate of the Old Testament prophecies, that he fulfilled all of them, and that today he remains as the gate of the sheep. God, we've come in and we've found, and we go out and we find pasture. We live our lives in him and through him and by his side at every juncture. And so, God, we want to recognize that, but we want to realize that there are other sheep that he means to call. And God, we believe, we firmly believe that the way he gets that done, the way you get that done, is not by appearing in a thundercloud and announcing yourself. You do it through the sheep. You send us out into that place out there to draw other people in as they learn to hear your voice. God, help us to listen. Help us to obey. We pray in the name of the Lord Jesus. Amen and amen. Okay, we huddled up. The play's out there, right? So I'm going to say, ready?
Ready.
Go get him, Potter's House.